Hello and thanks for joining us for this WTTW News special. I'm Brandis Friedman, and tonight we're looking at issues of policing and public safety.
The judge should have made the decision to keep that person in jail.
The killing of a Chicago police officer is renewing debate around a state law that made sweeping changes to Illinois' pretrial detention system. And a new book diagnoses violence as an epidemic and suggests ways to cure it completely. We'll get to that in just a moment, but first off tonight, local officials are highlighting research they say shows an overdose prevention site, sometimes known as a safe injection site, would go a long way to reducing opioid overdose deaths in Chicago.
Social services, healthcare services, emotional support services that sadly are not there and that are lacking in our systems. Being able to provide those care and services can reduce death. Even in one site here in the Chicago area, we could reduce the overdose deaths by half.
Some elected officials and advocates are supporting legislation in Springfield that would launch a pilot program on the city's west side to establish an overdose prevention site where people who use drugs would do so under supervision of trained staff. The group points to research from Brown University that shows such sites reduce overdose deaths by quickly providing emergency care, reducing the spread of infectious diseases, and linking users to other services. The pilot would be funded with an $18 million allocation from the Illinois Opioid Remediation Advisory Board. Some Joliet residents are asking state lawmakers to pass a measure that would slow the upload of more data centers in their community.
The people across the state are now looking at the 795-acre, 1.8-gigawatt Joliet Technology Center as the latest example of what happens when big tech arrives in town with bags full of money faster than public oversight, regulatory safeguards, and community consent could take their full course.
The Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition accuses Joliet city leaders of entering a confidentiality agreement with a data center developer and beginning discussions months before notifying residents. They say the center was approved publicly in just 3 weeks despite overwhelming community opposition. Residents are calling on lawmakers to pass the Power Act in Springfield, which would require data centers to pay for their own energy infrastructure and bring additional clean energy online, among other requirements. Up next, calls for changes to a state law dealing with pretrial release. That's right after this.
WTTW News coverage of policing and police reform is supported by the Joyce Foundation.
Sweeping criminal justice reform law in Illinois, known as the Safety Act, is under renewed scrutiny following the killing of Chicago police officer John Bartholomew. Critics are pointing to the law's changes to the pretrial detention system as having led to the controversial decision by a Cook County judge to allow Bartholomew's alleged killer out on electronic monitoring despite prior violent offenses. Illinois Republicans are pushing for changes to that law they say would make it easier for judges to detain defendants awaiting trial. Joining us are State Senator Terry Bryant, a Republican whose district in Southern Illinois includes Mount Vernon and Wayne City, and State Senator L.G. Sims, Jr., a Democrat whose district includes Chicago's Chatham neighborhood, Calumet City, and South Holland. He was the lead sponsor of the Safety Act. Senators, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Senator Bryant, I want to start with you. In what way do you think Officer Bartholomew's death, it highlights the problems with the Safety Act?
Well, first of all, the Republicans have filed a bill, Senate Bill 4195, which would basically just say that if someone is out on pretrial release and they commit another felony, that they would have to be locked up. So we know that the Safety Act had 12 subject matter hearings, but it never actually got a vote in a committee where you flush out a lot of the problems in those bills. And so I think there are changes that need to be made, just like with any bill that is 800 to 1,000 pages long.
And in what ways do you think the results of Alfonso Tally, the alleged, the accused shooter of Officer Bartholomew, under what parts of the Safety Act could he, should he have been back in jail?
Well, there are multiple ways. First of all, as I said, there are portions of the Safety Act that need to be, let's call it tweaked, if you will. Not necessarily, you know, I mean, there's pushback when you say change, but tweaking that law is what we do with laws when we find that there are gaps. There is a gap when someone is on pretrial release, they're on an ankle bracelet, and they're still released where they commit a heinous felony. Let's also keep in mind this particular offender was also on parole, should have had his parole violated, and also had absconded, who had left. So he was not only a parole violator, but he was on the run. And the apprehension unit for Department of Corrections was never notified. So there are a lot of gaps in how these individuals are getting by with not being detained properly and keeping public safe.
Senator Sims.
Well, everything that Senator Bryant talked about, the law contemplates. In a situation where this individual commits another crime, they would be held. The law contemplates that already, and it already calls for that. Certainly, we should not make sweeping changes when we have one instance or another. Let me be very clear: what happened to Officer Bartholomew should never have happened. It is a tragedy of the utmost pain for he and his family. And my thoughts and prayers are with he and his family and all of the Chicago Police Force, Police Department, and all of law enforcement around the state of Illinois and around the country. But the reality is the judge is the one who made the decision. He was the closest to the facts before him. He was the one who had the opportunity to see what was going on. He was the one, and Mr. Tally, he had certainly been before him before. The judge is the one, which is what the system calls for, to make the decision. We've had a situation where we've had mandatory minimums or formulaic decisions being made, and decisions being made for judges, as opposed to allowing judges to make decisions about the cases before them. In this case before them, given the set of facts before us, and as certainly as we all know them to be, this offender should have been held. But the discretion was with the judge to make that determination.
And we're definitely going to come back to the authority of the judges. Senator Bryant, do you believe the Safety Act, the impact that it has on police, do you believe that it makes it harder for police to do their jobs?
I think it makes it much harder for them to do their job. And I would say, you know, Senator Sims said that we don't need to make sweeping changes to the Safety Act. I don't think it's a sweeping change to make an adjustment where an individual who's on pretrial release, this change would just say that they have to be detained if they commit another felony. I don't think that's a sweeping change. I think that's a tweak that is not only needed, but is absolutely imperative that we make that change. I know you said we're going to come back to the judge's discretion, but I think one of the most important things that needs to be changed under the Safety Act is we probably need to take away some of the judge's discretion and make it a little bit more clear to the judges when they should keep that person detained and not. But I also want to go back again. I know this interview is about this particular change, but let's keep in mind again, we have an offender who was on parole in addition to the pretrial hold. He was on parole. He had no business being out in the public at all and should have had his parole violated and should have been locked up. So there's multiple reasons why this offender should not have been on the streets.
Senator Bryant, you and House Republicans, you filed legislation, as you mentioned, and I'm going to come back to you in a minute, Senator Sims, I promise. You mentioned Senate Bill 4195, which would make, you said, tweaks. Tell us about some of those tweaks, Senator Bryant.
Well, in this particular case with Senate Bill 4195, again, the legislation simply just says that an individual who's on pretrial release and commits another felony while they're on that release would have to be detained. So it does take judicial discretion away and just basically says this person has committed another felony. They don't get to go out. So it's too much to say that the person gets the fifth chance, the 10th chance, the 25th chance. And there are multiple other offenders, not just this one, but multiple other offenders who have gone back out and committed heinous crimes because they were allowed out on pretrial detention instead of being locked up. So if they commit another felony, they should be locked up while both cases are being adjudicated.
So after the shooting, Governor J.B. Pritzker said that, to the point of the judges again, said that the Safety Act, it wasn't the Safety Act that played a role, but it was a bad decision by the judge, John Like.
And in this case, I mean, it's a tragedy what's happened. Awful. And as you've seen in most of the cases where Republicans have complained about the Safety Act, it's actually been the bad decision by an elected judge in Illinois or no hearing at all because the prosecutor didn't bring it to the judge. And that has been a reason why somebody gets let out. A judge can make this decision. A judge should have made the decision to keep that person in jail.
Senator Sims, what about that? And what about what we've heard from your colleague, Senator Bryant, about whether or not the Safety Act gives judges too much authority, or are some erring towards release of someone, of an individual, in cases like this one and others, where someone who was on electronic monitoring then did commit another violent crime?
Sure. And that, again, that's where you hear what is being called a tweak is really a sweeping change. If you are taking discretion away from the judge to make the determination, that is a significant change. That is absolutely not a tweak. It is not a tweak to say that we're going to stop the judge from being able to make the determination. Again, the judge is the person who is sitting in, and I have sat in detention courts in Cook County and in others, where you see the judges who are presented with a set of facts. They have the opportunity to hear the individual's record. They have an opportunity to hear the risk assessment, which is what we've tried to do to make sure that we understand what threat the person presents to the community, to themselves or to others. And the judge is the one who is making that decision. They have the ability to make that determination based on the information presented to them. But on top of that, we're in a situation now where this judge made a determination. Now, I was not there. I disagree with it. I disagree with the decision. But we all have, right now, we all have the benefit of hindsight. And hindsight is certainly a benefit when you can look at the decision and make the determination after the decision has been made. But the judge is the person, again, an individual, an elected judge, a separately elected individual judge who was part of a co-equal branch of government, made a determination. It was a decision I disagree with, but it was a decision that we have as a legislature, and passing this law and passing this bill and having it be signed into law, have made a determination that as a co-equal branch of government, that is their decision to make.
Senator Bryant, could judges or should they be doing something differently to assess a defendant before making a decision on whether or not to detain them?
Well, I think they have to, obviously they have to take all of the information, not just small amounts of them. This offender had a long history of offenses over and over again, including felonies. I hope that because I hear both my colleague and I heard the governor place a lot of blame on the judge, and I'm not taking anything away from the judge. But there is also fault here to be had, as I said, with the Illinois Department of Corrections. I hope that while they're trying to point blame at a particular judge, they also point blame at the director of the Department of Corrections for not making sure that this person wasn't even out on the streets. But under the Safety Act, yes, I think that the judges, there are times when we need to look at it and say, maybe there is too much discretion given to the judges and we should take some of that back. This is a very simple, easy to wrap your mind around request that says that if they're out on pretrial detention and they commit another crime, they have to be locked up. That's simple.
All right. The Safety Act already allows for that. If there's a crime that's committed, the judge can always revoke the pretrial release and detain
it. It allows for, but it doesn't mandate.
In this case, it should be mandated.
I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate you both. That's where we're going to have to leave it. Senator L.J. Sims, Senator Taryn Bryant, thanks to you both. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, a Chicago program now on a global mission. Whether it's a school shooting or a political assassination, acts of violence create tragedies and fear in communities. But our next guest argues that they should also be viewed the same way we view outbreaks of disease. He argues in his new book, The End of Violence, Eliminating the World's Most Dangerous Epidemic, that violence should be treated as just that, an epidemic, but one that can be cured. Joining us is Dr. Gary Slutkin, author of The End of Violence, as well as physician, epidemiologist, and founder of Cure Violence Global, first known in Chicago as Ceasefire. Dr. Slutkin, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
So you've long referred to violence as a disease and not metaphorically. How is violence like tuberculosis or the measles?
Yeah, they follow the same rules of how they spread. I mean, some go through lungs and respiratory intestinal system. So this one goes through the brain. So we figured out in a way how violence goes from one person to another, how it goes within a community, and how it goes from one country to another as well. And this is one of the things that really struck me in the research that I was doing additionally. We had already shown that violence behaves like an epidemic. That was clear just by looking at the waves in maps, charts, graphs, the clustering, and we then went about in the first years of Ceasefire, which started, of course, here in Chicago, that it responded. The first time we tried it, it got a 67% drop. That is to say, the method itself. But since then, Ceasefire became, as you mentioned, Cure Violence Global. This has worked now in 60 cities, in 20 countries.
And to that point, you know, how did the violence prevention model that you developed here in Chicago, how does it serve as a blueprint for other cities and countries that you work in?
It already has, and I mean, by so many names. I mean, here in Chicago, it's being run by communities partnering for peace, for CRED, and the Institute for Nonviolence and others, but it's going now by dozens of names in thousands of organizations in at least 90 cities. There's a dozen cities or more that have gone to 50 or 60 year lows, some to record lows. The country as a whole, you may know, is at the lowest rate since for 125 years. And it's just not a coincidence that most of these cities and communities are now using parts or all of this approach.
So you also, you have research on, you know, how policies have impacted violence, you know, whether or not being tough on crime and incarceration works. But, you know, speaking about policing, how does the way we police communities in Chicago help or hurt the cycle of violence?
Well, I'm not sure the way it's working in Chicago right now. I mean, it's just simply, this is a public health approach. This is epidemic control. For the most part, this is led by communities with the guidance and training of people who have worked on epidemics. And policing is the backup to the backup. It's just not the front line because it has too many side effects. I mean, it is sometimes needed to have a little additional presence, but it's a distraction from the main approach. And the main approach really is finding the people who, as far as violence goes, are most likely to do a shooting, who might be thinking about it, and reaching them with people who they trust, who are now trained in cooling people down, and then changing their perspective, and then the community has a response part of this and so on. But this is very similar to what we did when I ran the TB control program. We had to reach people who were likely to be spreading it and changing the likelihood of that spread. Medicines were used, but fortunately it's not needed for violence. Same thing for cholera, we were reaching people. This was in Somalia. Same thing, reach people with the same people that they trusted.
Right, and in the case of violence, the treatment is not antibiotics. It is violence intervention by, like you said, by trusted community members who have experienced this, perhaps, and can talk young people, often young people, down away from committing further violence.
Exactly, it's behavior change, and we know how to do that now. We know how to help people get out of the fix they're in, and that prevents the spread, and that blocks the next cases. And that's how, I just want to add this in case everybody doesn't know this. There's 25 communities that I know of that have gone a year to 3 years with zero shootings or killings in this country, largely on the East Coast, three in this city, and also in Latin America. And the most violent city in the world in 2014, San Pedro Sula in Honduras, which had a rate of 10 times Chicago's, not twice, dropped 90% in the first 2 years. This was Cure Violence's Latin American team, which is a super team, as is the other teams that the organization has. I don't run the organization now.
Yeah. So in a country like Honduras, for example, I imagine it probably took a great deal of investment from the community as well as the government to create a 90% reduction like that.
It's always the community, just like it is here. It's always the community. It's always the people there who are trusted, who are just guided into how to do the steps. So epidemic control is a very specific stepwise method of mapping, finding out where it's happening, finding out who is trusted, finding out who has it, who has the problem, et cetera, and then preventing the spread. It's always about preventing the spread.
In the book, you also talk about authoritarian violence disorder.
Right.
What is that?
Yeah, so it's important to realize that violence of all of these forms, and you, Brandis, mentioned several of them, political violence, violence against children, against women in the family, suicide, all of these are different forms of the same disorder. And we know that because they cause each other, in war included. Authoritarian violence disorder is what I've been calling now for a few years, what we're seeing in this country and in other countries. And what it means is that we need to stop seeing this as politics and stop seeing it as government, but seeing it as violence having in a way taken over. And we can see this by the violence that's happening by government in cities. This city has experienced a lot of that.
You're referring to the immigration raids of last fall, for example.
I mean, it's not as if there couldn't be immigration enforcement, but this is brutality, cruelty, and violence. And we also see this through some of the what's called political violence of any form from any side, because violence spreads. It doesn't know one versus another. It just has this, it just takes its opportunity. And I just want to add to this that the book goes through, there's a whole chapter, chapter 8, on violence of the state and authoritarian violence disorder is described, as well as the playbook for interrupting it.
To that point, we've got about 30 seconds left. You provide action items for readers of the book to do their part. What are those?
Well, there's a lot. For one thing, there's things you can do yourself, you know, and to prevent your own exposure and that of your children. And it's also things that you can do for your community to make sure that it has either Cure Violence or some other CVI program that is at a sufficient intensity and so on. And the city here and the state here has been very good on this. The book also talks about all the syndromes.
Okay.
And what works for all of them.
All right. We're not going to give it all away on the show. They got to read the book if they want to find out. Dr. Gary Sletkin, thank you so much for joining us. Congrats
on
the book. Again, the book is called The End of Violence, Eliminating the World's Most Dangerous Epidemic. And for more on violence intervention, you can visit WTTW.com/firsthand. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
One note before we go, a little self-congratulations. WTTW was honored to win 17 Peter Lisagor Awards from the Chicago Headline Club for excellence in local journalism this past Friday night. In addition to wins by WTTW's local production teams for Jeffrey Bear's Touring Chicago's Lakefront and a number of Chicago Stories documentaries, WTTW News picked up 10 awards, including Best Community Reporting, Best Reporting on Race and Diversity, as well as for reporting on science and technology, health, education, features, headline writing, and 2 for our WTTW News Explains series. Congrats to all my WTTW colleagues in and out of the newsroom on these honors. It's a pleasure to work with all of you. And that's our show for this Monday night. Join us again tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. And the dark horse candidate who eventually became the head of the Roman Catholic Church. A look at Chicago's own Pope Leo and his leadership after 1 year on the job. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.